Hey, hi everybody, and welcome to tonight's teleclass, The Truth About Hoarding. I'm Wendy Haynes. My business is Skeletons in the Closet, and I would like to thank Angela for inviting me to guest present tonight on what is one of my very favorite topics. Like Angela, sorry, I'm a professional organizer, and I've been operating in Melbourne since 2006. I'm an expert level member of APO, which is the Association of Professional Organisers, and I'm one of two Australian organisers to have achieved the international designation of Certified Professional Organiser. I'm keenly interested in hoarding, and I have specialist certificates in chronic disorganisation and hoarding from the US-based Institute of Chronic for Challenging Disorganisation, otherwise known as ICD. And through the talk, I'll refer back to ICD and provide you a link to them as well. I work hands-on with hoarders in their homes on a regular basis, and I work in collaboration with other skilled professionals, the most notable being Melbourne's leading hoarding psychologist, Dr. Chris Mogan. So tonight I'm going to give you some facts about hoarding, but I'm also going to give you a whole lot of stories from my own personal experience out in the field. At times, I'm going to give you some web addresses to relevant resources. So if you're sitting in front of your computer, you can look those up as we go. Otherwise, just feel free to send me or Angela an email, and we'll send you a link later in the week. So let's go ahead and get started. So what is hoarding? A lot of people say to me, oh my gosh, my mother's a hoarder. She has every greeting card that was ever sent to her. Or my dad, you know, he's a hoarder. He's got every National Geographic ever published. And chances are your mom and your dad aren't hoarders. There's three very distinct characteristics that have to be present for a situation to be considered hoarding. And the first one is there's an obsession with acquiring objects that most of us would consider useless or of limited value. And an example of this is one of my extreme clients, and we'll call her Mary, and we're going to revisit Mary through the teleclass tonight. And Mary goes shopping daily with the single goal of coming home with as many items as possible for the money she has available on that day. She acquires trinkets, children's toys, clothing on sale, toiletries, cake mixes, those free recipes and magazines that you get at Coles and Woolworths. And she also purchases meat and dairy products that have been reduced because they're very close to their use-by date. And then she brings it all home, usually 6 or 7 bags at a time, and she drops it at the front door. And when I arrive a week later, I work with her every Friday, there's a pile of bags that are just a mishmash of rotting food and miscellaneous stuff. And when I go to start to sort through it and get rid of things, she becomes very, very angry. Even though she's had no interest in it since she dropped it at the door, she finds it almost impossible to throw it away. And that leads me to the second characteristic of hoarding, which is discarding anything causes extreme distress. Even rotting food, even out-of-date dairy products that haven't been refrigerated are almost impossible to let go of. I have one elderly client who can't even throw away a cereal box. She actually keeps them, gets out a Stanley knife, cuts off all the panels, and stacks them up, planning to use them as scrap paper. But she just can't use as many as she has, and over the years, she's acquired hundreds and hundreds of these bundles of little cardboard writing pads. The third component is that the clutter is so severe that it prevents areas being used for their intended purpose. And quite typically, I would see people who've lost use of their kitchen. That seems to be one of the first things to go. And it might be because they have the oven filled with paper. Often the fridge is broken down and full of food, but because either they're ashamed or, you know, there's not space, they haven't been able to get a repairman in or replace the fridge, so it's just sitting there broken and full of food. I quite often see people sleeping sitting up in a chair because their bed is completely covered with stuff. And in extreme cases, I see people who've lost use of their bathrooms. And I have one client in particular who holds down a job where she presents to the public. She has to look good. And she showers at her local gym, and she uses toilets at a nearby park. And I suspect none of the people she's presenting to would have a clue that she hasn't had the use of her bathroom for over a year. So we're looking for the three elements to make it hoarding: obsessive acquiring, inability to discard, and rooms that can't be used for their intended purpose. And I'd like to make the distinction here that hoarding is very different from collecting. Collectors are quite specific in what they acquire, and their collections are generally well organized and interesting. There's a certain pride in displaying a collection. On the flip side, people who hoard acquire many things seemingly random without any regard to their available space or need. And the objects become disorganized to the point that they interfere with everyday life. And there's a shame associated with hoarding rather than the pride that you see in collecting. So why do people hoard? Hoarding is an incredibly complex problem, and there's no simple cause and there's no simple cure. We know that there are certain factors that put people at risk, predispose them to hoarding. The first one that we think of is information processing deficits. So they may just have problems making decisions, or they may not trust their memory. They may need to have everything in sight, which then becomes counterproductive because there's so much in sight you can't see anything, and they start churning through it, and you know, things become more and more of a mess. They may suffer from anxiety or depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, attention deficit disorder. There is a school of thought at present that says there's a link to hoarding, between hoarding and ambiguous loss. And when I say ambiguous loss, I mean, you know, a loved one's gone missing. In an extreme case, you know, someone's gone to war and they haven't come back, they've been lost. Or there's some sort of an abandonment, a partner who's walked out on a relationship with no explanation, or maybe a child that's been given up for adoption, some sort of loss where the grieving is open-ended and there hasn't been any finish. Another situation might be that there's just been a very traumatic situation, such as a divorce or the death of a loved one. And this is particularly problematic if the person who is gone acted as a checkpoint in the hoarding. And a lot of times someone's hoarding can be kept in check because there's another person present who monitors the behavior. So when that person is gone, it's kind of like a double whammy. There's no monitor there left, and plus the person is dealing with grief and trying to fill that void. So hoarding that had been kept in check over time can suddenly escalate when this person finds themselves alone. There's also faulty beliefs about things like frugality and identity theft. And this is quite a complicated area because frugality can be a virtue and identity theft is quite real. But in hoarding, these rational beliefs, these beliefs that have some foundation, become disproportionately held. And I had a client early on who was so concerned about identity theft that her house had become absolutely filled to the brim with paper, to the point where the kitchen and laundry and many areas had become unusable. It's a case study that I gave in a hoarding interview for DHS, so I won't recount the whole saga here, but it is one that you can watch at my website if you're interested in hearing about it. In the case of Mary, who I talked about earlier, the hoarding was feeding her sense of identity. She lost custody of her 5-year-old daughter, but she constantly buys her gifts, really just to prove that she's a good mother. But when I suggest to her that she gives these gifts to her daughter, who's now in the care of a family member, she makes a lot of excuses not to, to let them go. So there's just bags and boxes and tubs of gifts for the daughter that she's now outgrown, or, you know, she's too old for now and she can't let them go. She also has in excess of 200 cake mixes because, once again, she likes the idea of cooking for people and taking care of people. But the reality is her kitchen hasn't been usable for many, many years. A lot of my older male clients fancy themselves to be handymen, and they have multiples, and when I say multiples, I'm talking 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, of old TV sets and VCRs that they intend to repair and sell, even though the technology is completely outmoded and it's completely unrealistic thing to think about doing. So we'll move along now to why hoarding is a problem. And I guess based on what I just said, you can think of many, many reasons. And first of all, the first one I want to look at is the emotional risks. One of the big problems with hoarding is that there's isolation and family rejection. And family members can become incredibly hurt and frustrated by the way the hoarder is choosing to live. And a lot of the time, their well-meaning attempts to help are actually quite misguided, and they can exacerbate the situation. And this is a very important point, and I'm going to come back to it a little bit later in the talk tonight. Another risk and problem with hoarding is that there's increased depression, anxiety, social phobia. There's a lot of shame associated with hoarding, and it's not unusual for people who hoard to isolate themselves and keep people out of their lives, and certainly out of their homes. A third problem is that medical conditions can be exacerbated, not just for the hoarder, but for the people around them. And I worked with one hoarding client, and I'm going to call her Janet. Janet was a professional woman. She was recently divorced with a teenage daughter. The house was absolutely full to the brim with items she kept because she didn't want her ex-husband to have them, which, you know, I just think that's the definition of cutting off your nose to spite your face. They had completely lost use of the living room and the dining room, and the mother and daughter tended to spend all of their time in the mother's bedroom, sitting on the mother's bed, which was all heavily cluttered. They ate dinner sitting on the bed, they watched TV sitting on the bed, they read. And on most of my visits, the daughter would be at home from school because she was suffering from asthma. And generally, throughout our entire three-hour session, she would lounge on her mother's bed while we worked. So eventually, after a number of sessions in that bedroom, I worked my way around to the far side of the bed and picked up a box of books, and the whole bottom of it fell out. And the books and the carpet underneath the box and the walls and everything I could see there was absolutely covered in mold. And at some point, the window had leaked, and because of just the sheer volume of clutter in that room, they had no idea that everything on that side of the bed was wet and completely moldy. So this room where the teenager was spending all of her time because she was too sick to go to school was actually the source of her sickness, and it was exacerbating her asthma, or it was probably the main trigger to it. Similarly, I often work with people whose tenancy is under threat because of their hoarding, and I've also worked with three women, including Mary, who have lost or were about to lose custody of their children because of their hoarding, which is an extreme situation, an extreme problem. Looking at the physical risks, one of the biggest ones is fire. The Metropolitan Fire Brigade, which I'll just call MFB from now on, have done research that shows that 24% of preventable deaths in fire are the result of hoarding. The main reason is that the fuel load is just so huge in a hoarding house that the fire spreads really, really quickly. Also, exits are usually blocked, so it's hard for residents to get out, and it's hard for firefighters to get in, and it just makes an explosive combination. I'll talk a little bit more about MSB later. It's an important topic that I need to spend a little bit more time on. Other physical risks are tripping hazards and narrow pathways. It's particularly a problem if people are getting older and their sight is impaired or they have mobility issues. And of course, where you have too much stuff, it's likely that you're going to have rats and mice and fleas and bed bugs and all of those good things. And of course, the mold and bacteria that I talked about earlier. So while I generally take a live and let live attitude to people's lifestyle choices, when you see the sort of hazards that I've just outlined, you do need to take action, not just for the good of the hoarder, but also for the safety of other people around them, the people who live in their home and their neighbors and the people in their community. So I will move along now and explode some myths about hoarding. And I've put my personal favorite right at the top. This is myth number one. A big clean out is the best way to help a hoarder. I hear this a lot. I call this dumpster therapy. And I often hear people say, you know, why don't you just get a skip? Why don't you just chuck it out? You know, I'll help. It'll be fun. But what they don't understand is that the clutter is only a symptom of the problem. So clearing the symptom doesn't fix the problem. And, you know, some people might say, well, you know, at least if the space is clean, they have a fresh start and they can concentrate on fixing all of their other problems. But unfortunately, it doesn't really work like that. Hoarding is a coping mechanism, so stripping it away without appropriate support can actually exacerbate the problem. Research done in the U.S. indicates that in 50% of cases where a rapid clean-out has been conducted, the hoarder will reacquire to the same level very quickly, and in 15% of cases, they will actually acquire to a greater level. An example of this that I've seen personally is Mary, who I talked about earlier with her shopping bags and her 200 cake mixes. Mary is 48, and she's had a hoarding problem for about 30 years. On four separate occasions, her family have forced a rapid clean-out on her, and on each occasion, her hoarding has worsened. So 6 years ago, they sent her on a nice overseas holiday, and when she returned, they said, surprise, we've cleaned out your unit for you again. And she said, surprise, I'm pregnant. And in the 9 months from the clean-out to the birth of her daughter, she reacquired so quickly that she was not allowed to bring her baby home from the hospital. And her daughter has spent her entire life in the care of a family member. So, you know, rapid clean-outs, they just don't work. My second favorite myth is hoarders are elderly and hoard because they grew up in the Depression. And certainly beliefs about waste and frugality can contribute to hoarding, but once again, only if they're disproportionately held. There are generally more complex issues at play in hoarding, and in reality, hoarding tendencies usually show up in early adolescence, and then they get, you know, worse with age, and typically they come to a head when that person's lost those checkpoints or there's been some traumatic event of, you know, something that tips them over the edge, and then, you know, the behavior becomes quite problematic. The third myth is that hoarders are poor or lazy or unmotivated or uneducated. And the reality is that hoarding is just like any other illness and it doesn't discriminate. It crosses socioeconomic groups, it crosses genders, it crosses professions. Many of my clients are professional people. Janet, for example, was a bank manager, actively employed, good at her job. These are people who are forced to keep a terrible secret, and you know, a lot of times they're leading, you know, almost a double life because I mean, if you went to the bank and sought advice or a loan or something from someone who was living in squalor, you would question that. But for the people that she's serving, they have no idea the type of life she's leading at home. And it's really hard to even get a handle on how many people in private housing may have a hoarding problem, because until you go into somebody's house, you really don't know what's going on behind closed doors. And unlike public housing, when you're in your own private home, there's no routine checks. There's no threat of eviction. And it's not until a concerned family member or maybe an angry neighbor or an occupational therapist or someone's come to visit your home for some reason that the situation's exposed and the alarm bells go off. The fourth and final myth that I want to cover, and this is a really sad one, is the idea that the hoarder loves their possessions more than their family. And certainly in Mary's case, her daughter could be forgiven for thinking that. Her mother has chosen all of those trinkets and cake mixes over her, basically. But hoarding is like any disease. It's like alcohol or gambling. The disease wants to isolate you. And for the hoarder, it's much easier to push people away and be alone with their disease than to deal with it. Last year, I was called by a professional man, we'll call him Mark, in his 30s, and he asked me if I could help his mother. She had gone into hospital for a hysterectomy, and an occupational therapist had visited the home to check whether it was safe for her to return. And this is quite a normal procedure when somebody lives alone and they're being discharged from hospital to check that their living environment is safe. At this point, her hoarding was exposed and she wasn't allowed to come home until her home could be made safe. So I met this lady, we'll call her Kathy, at the house. And we agreed on a pack-and-clean strategy. And a pack-and-clean strategy is basically pack up and clean. It doesn't really address the hoarding problem, but it would get her back in the house and give her an opportunity to recuperate, and then after that we could address the hoarding problem. And it's really important to note here that sometimes the hoarding is not the most immediate problem. So you need to set that aside sometimes, deal with it in a way you can, so that you can deal with what's most important. And at this point, the most important thing for Kathy was getting her back in her home so that she could recuperate from her surgery. Unfortunately, before Kathy and I could start work, she was diagnosed with advanced and aggressive cancer, and she died in the hospital within a matter of weeks. So it's a very sad situation. And I later contacted her son, Mark, and recommended to him a colleague who declutters and manages deceased estates in a very respectful way, you know, sifting through the hoard and extracting the items of sentimental value and the items of monetary value and, you know, disposing of the rest in a sensible way. And the son, he was almost angry at me for suggesting this. He wanted none of this. He was so angry at his mother, and he was just consumed with the idea that she had chosen her possessions over her family, and he just wanted to see the whole thing bulldozed. And I haven't heard from him, but I suspect that's probably what happened in that case. So, you know, there can just be this huge resentment within the family. So it all seems kind of hopeless. So, you know, what do you do if you or your loved one hoards? But, you know, there is hope. And the first step for anyone is to educate yourself. And remember that, like most things, hoarding is managed. It's not cured. So if you personally are struggling with hoarding, my best advice is to get into a hoarding support group. In Melbourne, Dr. Chris Mogan runs a very well-respected group that's had good success. Anyone interested can email me and I'll send you the contact details. At the moment, cognitive behavioral therapy is considered to be the most effective treatment for hoarding. There's no specific drugs for hoarding, But certainly medication for underlying issues such as anxiety or ADHD or depression can alleviate some of the triggers that cause you to hoard. So you want to be talking to an appropriate medical professional about that. If you happen to have a high degree of insight and motivation into your hoarding, you could pick up a book, Buried in Treasures by Randy Frost, Gail Steckety, and David Tolan. They're the leading authorities on hoarding, and Buried in Treasures is quite an easy-to-understand workbook-style book for helping challenge a hoarding problem. Other useful resources are the ICD website, and that's at www.challengingdisorganization.org. I'm currently studying with ICD, and if you go on their site, you'll find a lot of free fact sheets for the public or professional organizers, and you can pay to listen to some of their teleclasses for the public, or you can subscribe and, you know, have access to the full list of teleclasses, many of which are about hoarding. Also, the US-based OCD Foundation has good information on hoarding. Most of the information there is from Randy Frost and Gail Steckety again. And that website is www.ocfoundation.org/hoarding. And I just want to clarify here that hoarding used to be considered a subset of OCD, but in the latest Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM-5, it is recognized as a separate disorder. So, you know, people who have OCD may hoard, people who hoard may have OCD, but they're not as tightly linked together as was previously considered. Hoarding is a standalone disorder now. So that's if that was information if you're worried because you're a hoarder yourself. But if you're worried about a friend or a family member who has a hoarding problem, I would recommend that you buy right away the book Digging Out by Michael Tomkins. In my work, it's very rare that a person with a hoarding problem contacts me. I really don't see a lot of insight and motivation. I don't really see a lot of people who are ready to go down the Buried in Treasures workshop path. So typically, I won't be contacted by the hoarder themselves. I'll be contacted by someone, say, from an outreach agency who's concerned about the person's well-being or their safety or their tenancy. I might be contacted by an occupational therapist or an environmental health officer from the council who's become aware of a problem but doesn't have the time or the skills to deal with it. And sometimes I'm contacted by a psychologist who's working with the hoarder and thinks they're now ready for some hands-on help, but very rarely the person themselves. So in the vast majority of cases that I work with, the hoarder is resistant to help and has very little insight into their problem. And I often hear them say things like, well, you know, I don't even know why you're here. I don't know why everybody's making such a fuss. If I just had a bigger house, this wouldn't be a problem. Why can't you all leave me alone so I can get on with it? And all of these sort of excuses and things and minimizations of the problem. So in these types of situations where there is limited insight and limited motivation, limited readiness to change, you have to manage your approach very carefully. And conventional wisdom says that someone won't change until they're ready. But if they're at risk or their tendency is in crisis, sometimes we don't have time to wait for them to decide they're ready to change. So we have to find ways to motivate them. And one thing I can guarantee won't work is badgering, threats, and ultimatums. And unfortunately, that's the first course that a lot of well-meaning friends and family members take. The other thing that doesn't really work is over-focusing on treatment and focusing on quick solutions, you know, such as dumpster therapy. And these can really have the effect of closing down the conversation and also closing the door on the relationship you have with the person quite quickly. This is where Michael Tomkins' book, Digging Out, becomes very useful. and I recommend it to anyone dealing with a treatment-refusing hoarder. Michael Tompkins has developed a harm reduction model that's based on the clean needle sort of thinking. It's basically, if you can't stop a person from hoarding, let's at least keep them safe. So he gives a lot of good information about initiating constructive conversations. And one of the things that really stuck in my mind from his book is the idea of maintaining a relationship outside the hoarding. So if every time, you know, if you're my mom and every time I come to see you, all I talk about is your hoarding problem, your problem with hoarding, oh, your problem, pretty soon you're just not going to want to see me. So it's important to put effort into the overall relationship and then learn how to initiate constructive conversations about the hoarding problem. Conversations should initially focus on safety, and it makes sense. Safety is the single most important thing, and it's easier to talk to someone about safety than it is to say, you know, I don't really like the way you're living, because one is based on facts and information, and the other is just steeped in judgment. So once you've had these conversations and, you know, the person lets you in the door, you have to think about, well, what work am I going to do first? And the initial work, once again, should always focus on safety. Specifically, when I work with somebody, the first thing I want to do is clear exits and reduce fire hazards. And a great resource that I call on and that anyone can call on is MSB. And so the fire brigade are extremely knowledgeable and concerned about hoarding. There is a lady in Melbourne, Julie Harris, who is an absolute expert on hoarding in relation to fire safety, and she's very available, willing to talk with people. They will send a representative out to inspect a home, and in my experience, their people are always very kind but very firm with people, even in the most extreme situations. And I find that many of my clients are more receptive to fire safety information when it comes from a good-looking firefighter in a uniform than when it comes from me. So it tends to, you know, have a good effect, a positive effect. While they're there, they're usually willing to fit smoke detectors. And, you know, while we think, oh, well, yeah, everybody should have smoke detectors, that's mandatory, hoarding houses tend to have let the maintenance go. That's kind of an understatement, actually. And so a lot of hoarding houses don't have working smoke detectors, and yet, you know, they're the houses that are at the greatest risk. And another important thing is that the fire brigade maintain a registry of hoarders. So if your loved one's house goes up in flames, when that call comes through to the fire brigade, they will know it's a hoarding house, and they'll send extra units, and they'll send extra men, and they'll deal with it in a different way than they normally would a regular house fire. The next thing I would say about helping a hoarder is that you're going to have to let go of your own standards. And we all have different standards of housekeeping. And some of us are minimalist, and some of us like to be surrounded by a whole nest of goodies. And when a person is safe, that's probably when we're going to have to accept that that's enough. Their level of housekeeping is probably going to be a lot lower than our own. But if they're safe, we probably need to say, great, well done, and, you know, back off at that point. And we also need to know and understand and explain to them as well that backsliding will happen. So they're going to take two steps forward. They're going to take one step back. That just goes with the territory. And you and they should just be aware of that up front. Put the word around it. And not be disheartened when it happens. Say, oh, you know what, there's been a little bit of backsliding, but we're still ahead of where we started. And keep that positive momentum going. And you need to try and focus on the relationship rather than the stuff. And lead by example. And, you know, as I say, check your own personal housekeeping standards at the door. They're probably not going to be met at any point. Finally, I would say, and people forget this, you have to look after yourself. To effectively tackle a hoarding situation takes a massive collaborative effort, and it's unlikely that you by yourself would be able to fix this person's problem. Even with clients where I have an emotional distance that you don't have the luxury of having if you're dealing with a family member or a friend, I find that the work can be exhausting. And I work with a team of skilled professionals. I have a great trauma cleaner. I have great rubbish removalists. And when I say trauma cleaner, I'm talking about people who are highly trained in mold remediation. They have a, well, they're used to working at crime scenes and meth labs and you know, rather extreme situations. So they're equipped with their skills and sort of their mental preparation to work in a hoarding house. And, you know, most hoarding houses aren't the sort of places where you can call dial an angel and have a cleaner turn up. I think most of them would, you know, run from the room screaming. So you need a good trauma cleaner on your, you know, on your list of people. And I have a very good rubbish removalist as well that I really trust to deal with people in a caring way. I also have mental health professionals and colleagues that I can call on. But even with all of these really skilled people around me, I don't always succeed. I think I've probably failed as many times as I've succeeded in working with hoarders. And it can be really mentally and physically exhausting. So you have to practice self-care, and you know, you have to call in help when you need it. We're kind of on the home stretch of the call now, and Angela promised everyone an assessment tool, and I believe she sent the link. And it's my favorite tool. It's ICD's Clutter Hoarding Scale. And it's an observational tool that helps you assess the degree of clutter in four key areas. So if you have it in front of you, you can read along. Otherwise, I'll just explain. The first area is structure and zoning. So, you know, we're looking for things like car bodies in the front yard. That's usually a giveaway. A washing machine on the porch, that sort of thing. In the second category, we're looking at animals and pests. And I see a lot of cats and unmaintained kitty litter trays in my work. They seem to go hand in hand with hoarding. Insects and rodents are frequently a problem. And so really in this area, we're assessing how prevalent these factors are. The third area is household function. We're measuring how much the clutter is obstructing exits and obstructing rooms for being used for their intended purpose. And the final area is health and safety. You know, is food and medicine being handled safely? How soiled are surfaces? How regular is housekeeping? So the clutter hoarding scale is a good way to help you make sense of an overwhelming environment and to set realistic goals. It takes away the, you know, like that, the, oh my God, how can you live like this? And it turns it into, okay, this is what we're seeing. These are the problems. What can we do to dial it back a level? And clutter hoarding scale has 5 levels. And I would suggest that if you're working with somebody who's a level 3 on the clutter hoarding scale, that is considered to be elevated. And I would say that if you weren't trained to work with people in this area and you didn't have appropriate help, you really do need to call in professional help, because you not only put yourself at risk, you're putting the person you're trying to help at risk as well. So I just thought I'd take a quick look at level 3, the elevated level, and some of the, you know, characteristics of it that you need to look out for. And one is that, you know, things that should be indoors or outdoors, sitting on the lawn, that sort of thing. Things like, you know, the smoke detectors aren't working. In the animal area, we're looking at evidence of inappropriate animal control, you know, inadequate sanitation, you know, fish tanks with fish floating on the top and bird cages full of droppings, that sort of thing. We're seeing bed bugs, lice, fleas, cockroaches, ants, silverfish, all those nice things. With household function, we see that key living areas aren't being used. Exits and entrances and hallways are quite narrowed. at least one room can't be used for its intended purposes. Appliances aren't fully functional or they're being used inappropriately. So a lot of times we see, you know, heaters and things being used inappropriately. There's substandard housekeeping and maintenance. In the health and safety areas, you know, garbage cans are either not being used at all or they're overflowing. There's a lot of dust and dirt and debris. There's laundry scattered around. There's medicine sitting out where children or pets can get it. So that's the sort of thing we're expecting to see in a level three house. And that's the sort of area where I'd say, you know, these are serious risks, because going along with this, there is going to be a lot of, you know, pet dander and maybe animal droppings and those sorts of hazards and mold and all of those sorts of hazards. So you do need to know what you're doing and look after yourself. Another popular assessment tool is the Clutter Image Rating Scale. And that's on the OCD Foundation website, so you can find it there. And it's a really popular one because it's a pictorial one, and people just look at it and they go, oh, yeah, that's me. That's what my place looks like. And so people like to use it because it's easy, and it's one that the fire brigade uses. But I find in most cases it's kind of a measure of how deluded people are, because they tend to look at it and go, oh, yeah, I'm only a 1 or 2, and you're looking at it and thinking, oh, my gosh, they're like an 8 or 9. And the other problem I have with it is that it doesn't give you any information about important hazards like mold or insects or rodents. So just going by the picture, you may not be appropriately prepared or kitted up when you go into that environment. The final assessment tool, and I'll start winding things up, is the Home Environment Index. And it's a checklist that, if you'd like to contact me or Angela by email, I can send it to you. And I like this because you just go through and you tick the boxes. And it's got things like, you know, number, it's got 22 questions. Number 13, it asks you about dirty clothes. So you rate it from 1 to 4. You know, the hamper may contain a few dirty clothes, or the hamper is full and there's dirty clothes lying around and the inhabitant is wearing dirty clothes. And that goes right through to the last one, clothes cover the floor and other surfaces, inhabitant is wearing dirty clothes. And that could actually apply to a lot of teenagers' rooms, but it's quite useful in measuring what's going on in any household. Another one that, you know, is relevant is one about the dirty or clogged sink. So you're starting at sink is empty and clean. The next one is a few dirty dishes with water in the sink. The next one is sink is full of water, possibly clogged. And the fourth one, sink apparently clogged with evidence that it has overflowed onto counters, etc. And you might think, oh my gosh, well that, you know, you wouldn't see that very often. But the reality is in hoarding houses, a lot of the maintenance has just gone undone. And I can think of, you know, in Mary's house, one time when I was working there with my trauma cleaner and we were trying to clean the kitchen, the sink actually hadn't been used for a very long time. As you can imagine, a kitchen sink hasn't been used for a very long time. And so when the cleaner started to use it, very quickly the drain blocked, so we couldn't drain the water out, and at the same time the faucet broke, so we couldn't stop the water going in, and we couldn't get it to drain away, and my poor cleaner was standing there with a bucket bailing water out the kitchen window while I was frantically trying to get a plumber. And it wasn't very funny at the time, but in retrospect it must have looked like a little bit of a comedy of errors. So, you know, really we're looking at all of these things in a hoarding house that you just typically wouldn't see in a normal house, and you probably just wouldn't be prepared for from your own experience. So I'm just looking at the time, and I'm going to wind it up, and I think we've probably covered a lot of ground tonight, but if you only take one thing away, please take away that hoarding is a complex problem, and there's no easy fix, and I hope that I've given you some information that's useful, or at least pointed you in the right direction. And if you want any more information, please email myself or Angela Once again, I'm Wendy Haynes, and my business is Skeletons in the Closet, and my email address is wendy@skeletonsinthecloset.com.au. And thank you very much for attending tonight, and I look forward to hearing from anyone with any questions. Thanks.
Thanks, Wendy. Thank you very much.